Take a network break. It's Cyber Monday in the U.S., so we're offering a two-for-one special on virtual donuts. You buy two, and we get one. Today's show tackles a new AWS firewall offering, the newest twist on Britain's expulsion of Huawei, and the latest financial reporting. We're sponsored today by Linode. Linode Linux virtual machines let you develop, deploy, and scale your modern applications in the cloud faster and easier. You can get started on Linode today with $100 in free credit for listeners of the Network Break podcast. Find all the details at linode.com/networkbreak. And stay tuned after the news. We've got a sponsored Tech Bytes conversation with Thousand Eyes about new capabilities, including multi-service views, hybrid cloud visibility, and more. Last but not least, check out ignition.packetpushers.net. That's our sponsor-free subscription site. It offers instructional courses, white papers, and insightful analysis and commentary. We've got video courses on Ansible, Python for networking, a new SD-WAN course, and coming soon, Learning BGP with Russ White. A $99 annual subscription gets you access to everything on the site. That's ignition.packetpushers.net. Greg, you were off last week. Welcome back.
Yes, I took a break. I actually went completely dark. I deleted the Twitters and stopped answering emails and declared a Twitter bankruptcy. I'm looking at my RSS feed and thinking I might actually have to do something similar.
I'm sure.
So far behind. Yes. So, you know, if you sent me an email or sent me a Twitter last week, I just probably won't see it. So, and I think that's the right way to do it, I think, these days.
I mean, if you're going to take some time away, why not go dark, decouple from the internet, and let your mind go free?
Obviously, in lockdown, I didn't get very far.
Yeah, that's why I said your mind.
Yeah, I went all the way to SOF, like sofa, and every now and then to KIT, kitchen, and then occasionally up to BRM, bedroom, you know.
Is your airport codes for your house?
That's it, yes, airport codes, to give me that sort of that sense of, you know, differentiation, travel, you know.
No, we're all in that boat. If you can find a way to astrally travel, maybe that's an option. But yeah,
some weird things. I've never owned a game console in my life, so I bought a PlayStation 4 secondhand. Went to the local shop that sells secondhand PlayStations and just picked one up. Figured that it was cheaper than a plane flight. By the time you go to the airport and park and do the things and get on a plane and get off a plane, it's probably for two people. Well, that's the cost of a PlayStation, so I bought a secondhand PlayStation.
Sure.
And I spent the week sort of fiddling around with PlayStation games, most unsatisfyingly. Really not sure what everybody's way of getting on about a PlayStation. So, yes, and for all the people who are all about PlayStation, yes, but you couldn't buy one. And I wanted it then. So I just went and got a secondhand one. So, all right. Recycling.
Very good. Doing your bit.
Yes.
All right, let's jump into some news. You may have noticed last week when AWS coughed, the internet catches a cold, disruptions at the cloud giants. US East 1 region sent ripples of anxiety through the web a day ahead of the Thanksgiving holiday in the United States. The timing spooked engineers and admins because the retail sector of the US banks on the long Thanksgiving weekend of online shopping to drive year-end revenues. Alarms began firing at 5:15 a.m. PST on last Wednesday, and the service wasn't fully resolved until 10:30 p.m. PST, so about 17 hours.
The thing that you're looking at here is that the big cloud companies, particularly AWS, has this interlocking set of services. And the metaphor I like to think of the public clouds is that a lot of us run data centers and they're kind of like light planes. They're fairly simple. They've got engines. They don't hold a lot of, you know, don't carry much. But if you want to really scale up air travel, you end up with a jet, a 737 Max.
Yep.
And those entire systems become... Because you're now carrying 360 people on a plane, you can't just sort of go like, you know, near enough. Sort of, you actually have to be like, when a big jet hits the ground unexpectedly, it's a very bad thing, and it gets on the press, and markets suffer, and people lose faith, and so the problem is that as you scale up these services and you put more and more loads into them, and they become more and more visible, is they actually get harder and harder to keep running properly. And I think we're going to see a lot more of these cloud failures. And the decode, the good part is that Amazon's being moderately transparent about what actually happened. You can go and read it. There's a link in the show notes, and it's all over the social medias if you want to search it up. It's a good read, and it seems to be, as I said, modestly transparent. I think there's a certain amount of legal in there that might have filtered out some of the things that might have otherwise been said. But basically, there's a service in there called AWS Kinesis, which processes streaming telemetry, and AWS eats its own dog food. And when Kinesis goes down, all the other services that depend on it go down. And that's not just customers, that's AWS themselves. One of the more interesting parts was that this included AWS status dashboard. So people were going to the status dashboard, and as they say, with an event such as this, we typically post to the service health dashboard. During the early part of this event, we were unable to update the service health dashboard because the tool we use to post these updates uses Cognito, which was impacted by this event. So we have a backup means of updating the service health dashboard that has minimal service dependencies. While this worked as expected, we encountered several delays during the earlier part of the event in posting to the service dashboard, as it is a far more manual and less familiar tool. So in other words, the fallback, the normal way for an update was to use Cognito, and then there was even a fallback, but nobody actually knew what the double fallback was, and nobody could use it. So people spent hours probably trying to work out, well, we've got a backup tool. That sounds very familiar to me. That's enterprise IT.
It really does.
Right? That is not. That's a real admission of, like, in enterprise IT, that's literally like, who remembers how to do that? Who wrote that?
Where's that binder? Yeah. What shelf was it on?
No, that guy left 5 years ago. How does this work? You know, yeah. Who we call? Who do we call to get this? You know, that's what that sounds like to me. So I think that's my summary of it. It's not that AWS has an outage. This is one, and there'll be many more. It's the fact that the outage was built because of interdependencies between the services, and AWS's habit of dogfooding is a danger as much as it's a positive. So it's a positive in the sense that because AWS uses Kinesis, it would generally be tested. On the other side, if it uses it and it goes down, all services around it go down with it. So
Yeah, I agree. I feel like this highlights the tenuous chain of dependencies that not only our own applications and services are tied to, but AWS's own applications and services. So as always, a good reminder, one, just to be aware of those dependencies and do what you can to mitigate reliance on one single instance. And the other is test those backup and business continuity plans.
What's interesting, though, I don't know if I was looking through some tweets this morning of it, following some Twitter threads and so forth, you know, people complaining that they can't do their vacuuming because AWS East is down, which, you know, things like that.
I saw that.
What's interesting is nobody seems to be blaming AWS. So nobody's threatening lawsuits or stamping their hands and demanding a refund. They're all just shrugging their shoulders and going like, oh, well, this happens.
That's a good point. Right? There are complaints, but there's no, I mean, we used to see screams and cries of, the cloud, it's not safe, don't go there, it's unreliable. And now it's more like, yeah, this happens, we'll get on, move on with it.
Yeah, odd, isn't it? Like, AWS gets a free pass. Like, AWS goes down, everybody goes like, oh, well, I'm sure they're going to get fixed. You know, it's been down for a half a day. Nobody's going like, where's my $50 million damages coming from?
Right.
Right? Why are we, if we had a major vendor like IBM or HPE or Dell who did something and the service went down, we'd be seeing lawsuits being thrown out of the corporate pram going like, well, you shouldn't, you're a bad supplier. You have to make good, blah, blah, blah.
Probably, although there may be that happening in the background. Some large customers who may have been impacted by this may be contacting AWS about their service level agreements. Mm. But I guess AWS has built enough of a reputation, and perhaps we've become accustomed enough to cloud to know that these things happen, that they do get a pass and we just shrug it off.
It's interesting though, isn't it, right? Why isn't Jeff Bezos out making a personal apology and getting it sorted? Because that's what you would normally expect to see. Why does he get a free pass? No. It just seems odd to me. And I bet, and I mean, AWS doesn't care. Like, enterprise IT walks up and says, I'm not going to use your service. AWS is going to go, fine, see ya. Don't let the door hit you in the bum on the way out, will you?
You know, that's part of it, that their whole business culture is take or to leave it.
You can complain all you like.
That helps. Mm. Yeah. There's the complaints department. It's also
It's a real disconnect there, right? You know, that people have bought into no customer service.
I mean, a fantastic trick if you can pull it off. I don't know that everybody can, but AWS certainly has. All right, well, staying with AWS, the cloud giant recently announced a new managed firewall service that runs in its VPCs. This includes traditional stateful firewall capabilities as well as IDS IPS functions using signatures from the open source Suricata project.
The firewall service that AWS had was L3, then it was L4. And then obviously the demand is there for an application style of firewall. I generally get the sense that AWS doesn't really want to do networking. It would much rather just not bother. In this case, they've turned to an open source project called Suricata, picked out the pieces of it that they want, and added it in as an application firewall functionality. It says in the documentation, network firewall uses the open source intrusion prevention system, Suricata, for stateful inspection. but only a subset. So they actually specifically say the actual functions are highly restricted and only a very basic set of functions are actually implemented, which you might expect when you're operating at its scale. You don't want to have this infinitely flexible tool. On the other hand, it doesn't actually do very much. It's basically this. I then went and had a look at the Suricata project and noticed that AWS is not a sponsor or a supporter of the Suricata project. So they've literally gone and taken the open source work of somebody else and using it to make money. Speaking of making money, 6.5 cents per gigabyte through that firewall. That is reassuringly expensive, as we used to say. That's a pretty expensive firewall. If you're paying per gigabyte, you can expect that to be really, really painful to deploy. So on one hand, AWS firewall with application inspection using what you would probably know and trust, which is a Suricata, which is well known. On the other hand, at 6.5 cents per gigabyte, you might want to look at a third-party firewall still. There's still room there for the Ciscos and the Palo Altos and the Checkpoints of this world.
Yeah, it's interesting because we see AWS move into adjacencies that end up maybe driving out partners, but Palo Alto and Checkpoint and others did release statements saying how they're partnering with AWS around this firewall. Palo Alto says it's integrating the AWS firewall with its XSOAR incident response platform, so you can get feeds from the AWS firewall into this platform if you need to do incident response. And Checkpoint's putting it in its CloudGuard service to monitor configurations and look for compliance violations. So finding a way to cooperate and compete at the same time with their partners.
I think that demonstrates one of my talking points that I use a lot, which is the actual firewall itself is trivial. The fact that Palo Alto and Checkpoint, and I'm sure others, will integrate the AWS firewall because they have to try and maintain relevance. But the actual firewall that does the data plane compliance, if you want to look at it that way, actually is less important than the actual control plane, which decides what rules go into the firewall and makes decisions about it. So the idea of it, of your firewall having to be a Palo or a Checkpoint or whatever, is much less relevant going forward than the management software that draws all your security policy together by the software-defined part of it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think that's going to be where a Palo Alto, a Checkpoint, other Fortinet, other security vendors are going to have to go above and beyond, not just saying, you know, an AWS cloud firewall could be good enough for customers. They're going to position their value as we'll help you manage it better and integrate it with your on-prem stuff, your edge stuff, your other public cloud stuff, as opposed to just having to live inside AWS.
I mean, the value of this firewall is its integration with the AWS management consoles and its system administration tools and its logging tools and all that sort of stuff. But the disadvantage of the way that AWS operates is it basically puts everything into a proprietary stack, that is the AWS stack, which has some open APIs, but all the data is contained inside a proprietary software that AWS owns. So it's going to be interesting to see if people can try and make that AWS firewall compatible with its other firewalls in other places. And I noticed this week that we saw the head honcho of the Google Cloud Platform saying that we need to be careful that all of the public clouds don't become proprietary lock-in environments. Which was
what? Too late. That's their whole point.
Yeah, that's the whole point of especially AWS and Azure is to lock you in, is to keep you, you know, nicely contained within a, you know, with a sort of a faux open, you know, pseudo open. And,
yes.
You know, we publish parts of it that you can use, and we'll call that open. So the open part of open source is not necessarily just an API with open access.
One other thing to note, I noticed that logs can be sent to, talking about interdependencies earlier, logs from the AWS firewall can be sent to S3, CloudWatch, and Kinesis, which is the system that failed. So again, those interdependencies and potential knock-on consequences you need to be aware of when adopting a cloud service that's also using its own services.
Yeah, I think we'll see more outages as these services get more complicated. It's like jet planes. When they first started flying jets, they found all these failures and there were so many accidents. And eventually you had to have these safety boards doing detailed analyses to make sure that these complex systems in jet aircraft were actually stable and reliable. And I wonder how long it will be before something similar. And considering how mission critical these
things are. FAA for the cloud, okay.
It's not unlikely. I mean, I think the governments will be forced to step in at some point because these companies are still pretty YOLO. And at some point they'll become strategic to society and the governments will have to step in and say you have to operate at a certain quality level. That is on the cards. All right.
Let's put that on the prediction sheet, the FAA for cloud. We'll keep an eye on that for 2021, I guess.
Yeah, that's not socialism, by the way. That's just regulation, just in case somebody's got a bee in their bonnet about that. Yeah.
All right, links in the show notes if you want to get the gory details on the outage and also on the new firewall. Let's move on. Don't hold your breath for running Linux on Apple's new M1 ARM-based silicon. Linux creator Linus Torvald says he likes the idea, but he's citing a lack of cooperation from Apple. In an interview, he said, quote, "The main problem with the M1 for me is the GPU and the other devices around it, because that's likely what would hold off me using it, because it wouldn't have any Linux support unless Apple opens up."
Obviously, the M1 silicon is very attractive to a lot of people. We've seen Apple announce it, and the reviews are in of the actual product, and it's pretty mind-boggling how much performance there is and the battery life that Apple's been able to get out of it. There is any number of detailed articles diving into why the M1 silicon is so far ahead of Intel silicon, and has to do with a whole bunch of really tight integration between the operating system and the CPU, and also certain architectural decisions inside of the CPU itself. But also, it's a SoC. The M1 comes with the graphics and an artificial intelligence and, you know, a whole bunch of silicon. And one of the things that a lot of people don't know is that Intel spends hundreds of millions of dollars a year contributing to Linux to run on x86 CPUs. Now, this hundreds of millions comes in the form of hiring people who exist to contribute code to the kernel. Also comes in the terms of financial support for various organizations and sponsorship of open source organizations. But it seems reasonable to assume that Apple is unlikely to do that. Apple has no great interest in doing anything that it doesn't want to do. And like AWS, it likes to take open source projects or various GNU projects and just adapt them willy-nilly and exploit them for their own gain and give very little back. So I think Linus Torvalds is right. He would probably like to have the reputed performance of an M1, but he would need Apple to help them. They would need to contribute code to the Linux kernel, probably developers publish open specifications that can be consumed. And that seems highly unlikely given where Apple's been for the last decade or so.
I'm guessing that Apple's looking at the market for Linux running on M1 and thinking, not worth the effort.
And Apple's going to get nothing out of it. Running right. Linux on an M1
Want you to run Apple.
Yeah. I just don't think that Apple would say that's what we do. Apple tends to rely on a very small number of highly paid, specialized individuals. That's a very broad thing. They don't run to large numbers of people working in big projects. They run to a small number of people who are working far too hard for very, but get paid a lot. Small teams are effective teams. It's generally my broad assumption of what they're doing. And I doubt that they would want to be stuck, you know, sharing the contents of their M1 silicon with the Linux community at that level. They would much rather focus on iterating, I believe, the silicon to the next level and not have to try and, you know, answer for backward compatibility and so forth, such as Intel's done over the last 20 years.
Right. And it makes sense for Intel to be behind Linux because they want to sell as many servers as they can to cloud providers who are using Linux. So.
Yeah. Intel saw the opportunity to create Linux and that it wanted to be a platform for Linux. So I think that's probably fine for the time being. Who knows what will happen going forward. But I agree with that. There doesn't seem to be any way that Apple will jump on the Linux bandwagon. I don't think there's anything in it for that.
All right, quick break to tell you about our sponsor today, Linode. Whether you're working on a personal project or managing enterprise infrastructure, you deserve simple, affordable, and accessible cloud computing that allows you to take your project to the next level. You can simplify your cloud infrastructure with Linode's Linux virtual machines and develop, deploy, and scale your modern applications faster and easier. You can get started on Linode today with $100 in free credit for listeners of the Network Break podcast. All the details are at linode.com/networkbreak. They've got 11 global data centers. They provide 24/7/365 human support. There's no tiers or handoffs, regardless of your plan size. And in addition to shared and dedicated compute instances, you can use your $100 credit on S3 compatible object storage, manage Kubernetes, and more. So host your website, build your app, store, or backup media. It's up to you. And it's all free with $100 in Linode credit. Visit linode.com/networkbreak. Click on the Create Free Account button and get started. And if you want to find out more, check out Linode's YouTube channel for video tutorials, security tips, and more. That's youtube.com/Linode. All right, back to the news. British telecom companies have to stop installing Huawei gear by September of 2021. This is according to a new law. Under the previous rule, British telcos had until 2027 to install any Huawei gear they had purchased before the end of 2020.
So we've been tracking the Huawei UK aspect for an extended period, probably 2 or 3 years now, and talked about it. I think there was a couple of things here. It was originally they said 2027, so that was sort of like a natural aging out. And I think we've talked before about Huawei being in perhaps up to a third of the 5G, of the 4G networks inside the country today. So maybe it's a lot less, but take your numbers with a dose of salt. But the interesting part here is that the British government has now moved the end of life date forward from 2027 to 2021, but they're also putting out £330 million to assist the telcos with replacing it. As soon as I saw that number, did you get a feeling, Drew? Did you get a feeling that that's like $1/3 of $1 billion?
Did that triggered something for you?
Yeah, that did. Just a little too tidy. Yeah, it's just a little too tidy. That's like, we need a number. What number? Well, we can't give them a billion, and a half a billion sounds too big, and a quarter of a billion sounds too big. Let's give them a third of a billion. So we'll call it £333 million. Let's say this has all the stink of a political thing, not founded in a whole lot of research. And there's somebody in a back room looking at the press release going like, what the? Do you know?
We need a number that sounds good. What sounds good?
This is politics by press release, I suspect. There are existing programs that are still deploying Huawei equipment. They must cease by 2021. And then the effective end of lifing of a Huawei in the national infrastructure starts at that point. So they were going to let the telcos run until 2027. What they're saying is any new installations can only continue until September of next year. I think it's very interesting that the government's continuing to move down the path of the previously stated US position, because obviously the US politics thing here about no Huawei in Western networks, particularly in Five Eyes countries, seems to still have momentum with the UK government. You know, and with the changing of the US government next year, perhaps this is a sign that they're either not waiting for a transition there or for that pressure to come off, or they believe that pressure will continue under the new administration.
Yeah, I've been reading some stuff here in the US about the incoming administration, and what I've read so far says that the stance toward China may not change substantially, given essentially how well it's been received by the U.S. populace. So politically speaking, not changing course may be good for them. And just to round this out, we've talked in previous episodes about growing investment in Open RAN. And last week, we mentioned a proposal by the U.S. to allocate $750 million in grants for U.S. companies to develop telecom gear using Open RAN standards. So Open RAN as a counterweight both to Huawei and also to the duopoly of Nokia and Ericsson, if you're deciding not to go with Huawei.
Yeah, Nokia and Ericsson have sort of earned that in a way. They haven't been excellent partners. And apparently Verizon's had a major falling out with Nokia around certain things, part of why Verizon chose Samsung, which we talked about a couple of months ago. The road forward is very confusing in the 5G space.
All right, let's wrap up with some financial results. We'll start with Palo Alto Networks. They reported their Q1 results for fiscal year 2021. They had total revenues of $946 million, which grew 23%, although the company did post a net loss of $92
million. I think the interesting part about the Palo results is just how far they grew. They got year-over-year growth between 17 and 19% and quarter-over-quarter growth of 18 to 19%, which is quite a bit higher than most other companies, I think. I took a look at Cisco's financial results. Their security division was only getting 10 to 12% quarter over quarter, year over year growth. So Palo Alto is doing a much better job of growing. But the flip side is, of course, that Palo Alto now has SD-WAN. They have the exhaust, the exhale service, I think it's called. They've acquired a number of other services which they've snapped in. So they've been growing that business unit, whereas Cisco hasn't been acquiring new business units and Checkpoint hasn't been acquiring those business units. So I sort of see it as Palo Alto is doing very well, but I don't think you could compare it to other security companies from the traditional vendors, from the branded vendors like security and like Cisco and Checkpoint, perhaps against Fortinet, because Fortinet had very similar results and their SD-WAN is in the portfolio. So good results for Palo Alto. Obviously, it's a reflection of the pandemic, the transition as people go to work from home, the firewall, the security methodology that you do to secure the perimeter of what's in place for a lot of enterprises probably means that they picked up a lot of revenue. Whether they can hold on to that as the world changes to much more remote working, whether their VPN remote working distributed work strategy is in the right place, well, that's something that we'll have to see as time passes.
Although they did anticipate a sunny year ahead, they raised their guidance for the full fiscal year and are predicting revenues of $4 billion for the full fiscal year of 2021. So they do seem bullish. VMware also announced results for their third quarter of the fiscal year 2021. It's the little engine that could, and it keeps on going. They had revenues of $2.86 billion, up 8% year over year, and net income for the quarter was $434 million.
The first thing that struck me was you forget sometimes, because when you look at percentages, which is what actually matters, it's not a part of what VMware is about is not how much it sells, it's whether it grew and how much more profits it made in the time frame. And at $2.86 billion, you forget just how small that is. That is, you know, Cisco does $12 billion a quarter, 12 to 13, give or take. Dell does, I can't remember.
Much more. We'll cover that.
Yeah. But when you're a pure software company, if you're not selling metal, your revenue is much smaller, but your cost base is much smaller. And that's reflected in the fact that they're getting massive growth in profits, relatively. It's very interesting. Very interesting to note that for all the impact of VMware on enterprise IT, its actual revenue is, in terms of gross numbers, is just smaller than you think.
Yeah, I feel like their presence is outsized comparative to their revenue. They swing weight bigger than you would think based on how much money they make. Mm. Their influence is substantial, yeah. Also to note, we're talking about a lot of companies transitioning toward a more subscription and services-based revenue model. VMware is doing the same. They said their revenues from subscriptions and SaaS were up 44% and now are accounting for almost a quarter of their revenue.
We've talked about the enterprise licensing agreements and whether customers like it or not, they're going to love them.
That's right. Kicking and screaming.
Kicking and screaming all the way down. So the fact that that's up is not a reflection of what customers want.
All right. Last but not least, Dell Technologies, they also announced Q3 results for fiscal year 2021. They had revenues of $23.5 billion, up 3% year over year, and net income of $881 million. So there's an interesting comparison, right? They had just twice the income of VMware, but like 10 times the revenue.
That's the thing about hardware is that you sell a lot, but it costs a lot, right? Whereas all you sell is a software license in an enterprise license agreement, your cost is a bunch of fleshy meat robots in a high-rise building somewhere. The cost structures are very much different, but your impact is also different as well. Hardware is very sticky, whereas software can be displaced fairly easily. Keep in mind, too, that Dell is saddled with a substantial amount of debt. They had a buyout with Silver Lake Partners. Part of that process involves some pretty fast and loose financial mechanics to extract a lot of money out of it and loaded the company up with debt. And as it comes back to market, it needs to pay that debt out. And that's what Silver Lake Partners are famous for, of course. Load them up with debt, pull out one-off dividends, and then put the company back in the market and say, oh, you know, we re-engineered this company. It's so much more efficient. Removed all of the deadwood, changed it all, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, and don't worry about that $42 billion in debt that's been attached to the company.
No, we've got that all sorted. We've got a plan. We've got a plan.
So just to break it out by business unit, Dell's laptop and PC business brought in $12.3 billion for the quarter. Their infrastructure division was $8 billion, which is just about evenly split between storage and servers. I should note that Dell's revenue also includes VMware's revenue, so a neat little trick. All right, links in the show notes if you want to dive into the gory details yourself. That does wrap up our news portion. Stay tuned for our Tech Bytes conversation with ThousandEyes. We're talking about their expanded visibility for internet and hybrid cloud services. That's coming right up. Welcome to the Tech Bytes podcast from the Packet Pushers. Today, we're talking visibility with sponsor ThousandEyes. The company is rolling out a host of new improvements to the platform, including VPN visibility, API monitoring, and more. Our guests from ThousandEyes are Angelique Medina and Archanek 7. Welcome back to the show. You've been here a lot. We're happy to have you back. So you've got a lot of news. One of the things we're going to be talking about is multi-service views that you're adding to the platform. What does that mean?
Yeah, multi-service views is really interesting because it's kind of an expansion of what we already do in terms of taking different data sets and correlating them all into a single view. And what we've done up until this point is focus on the different layers. So looking at, for example, the application performance, looking at network performance and path visualization and routing and all of that and putting that in kind of a single view. But now what we're talking about is taking different service legs and stitching them together so you can see sort of end-to-end visibility around a particular service. For instance, you know, it's not just a matter of connecting, say, to an application server. DNS is also a part of that journey from a customer standpoint. So, you know, maybe looking at that alongside application performance and then maybe even some of these back-end services. Or, for example, looking at overlay and underlay visibility alongside one another. So that's sort of the notion that you can get this really kind of macro 10,000 foot view. It's really helpful for identifying issues.
So not just the application itself, but all of the dependencies around that application, like DNS, for example, and we always know it's DNS.
Exactly, exactly.
Except for when it's Wi-Fi.
Or when it's BGP. Yes. So, those are sort of the triumvirate.
I think it's valuable here to talk about, obviously, that genesis of the Thousand Eyes business was we monitor the internet, we monitor all the BGP state. And then over the years, the product has grown and matured in multiple directions. And now the BGP monitoring the internet is a key product, but it's also there's probes you can put on site, you can start monitoring DNS, you can monitor the state of SaaS services, you can see if Google's up or YouTube's up and this type of stuff. You know, when you gave us a demo of the visualization interface, it felt to me like this is the natural evolution. Once you've realized that you've got a lot of services, the trick is, how do I break down what's happening so that I get to the fault? How do I get to the innocence? Like, in the meantime to innocence, how do I get to the innocence part as quickly as possible?
I think that's a really good point. Our evolution has in some ways kind of mirrored the evolution of the adoption and usage of a lot of different services like cloud and internet that's come about with SD-WAN. I think it also speaks to kind of the people angle as well, because a lot of what we initially did was to address the different silos within an organization, because you might have the network team, you might have the application team, and oftentimes they weren't really speaking kind of a common language, and there was a lot of finger pointing. And so, you know, putting these different data sets on top of each other so you can kind of quickly, you know, look across all of them and identify where the issue was happening was what we initially focused on. And we really do recognize that a lot of the teams are not internal to the org anymore. They're sitting outside of your organization. So you have to work with like your cloud provider, your service provider, and maybe their vendors and their service providers. So the teams are kind of everywhere along with the infrastructure and the services. And so you really need to have a much more expansive view of, you know, what the end-to-end performance looks like.
So can you give us a use case for multi-service use to kind of put some meat around it?
Yeah, for sure. One particular use case that we were seeing a lot is around SD-WAN. So you have your kind of like your overlay visibility, and that might be between two SD-WAN endpoints. A lot of what's sort of obscured when folks start to adopt SD-WAN is really that underlay path, which is really important because that could be your service provider, but also other ISPs as well, and even cloud provider networks.
The internet very often is actually ISPs all the way down. Sometimes you can be six providers deep.
Yep.
You
know.
Yeah, so I want to push on that a little bit, because one of the value propositions that an SD-WAN vendor will say we give you is visibility that you never got before, but you're saying there's still a missing piece to that picture?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they will give you, for example, like end-to-end performance availability. So you might be able to know kind of from one SD-WAN endpoint to another, or even from your SD-WAN edge to a SaaS provider, like what is my overall kind of performance? Is the app up or down? But what they don't give you is that really that very granular kind of hop-by-hop information. So you can identify if there is an issue, you know, who's responsible, which ISP, is it the service provider or the application provider, is it within their network, and even down to the interface level, what the problem is and where it is. So that's really, really kind of the key information that we're providing.
So I think, you know, the decoupling of the underlay and the overlay, that is something that, you know, we've always been doing. And the cool thing about the visualization and the multi-service views is now you can actually see the underlay and the overlay together in one single dashboard or view. And, you know, you can not just look at it to one particular service, but to many different services altogether. So if there is a commonality in the path that is impacting your application, that can kind of, you know, surface up really quickly as well. So again, going to the point of what does this enable is really to be able to expedite that troubleshooting, because when you're having all of these, you know, external dependencies coming together, being able to see them in one consolidated view definitely helps, not just to Angelique's point, one team, but many teams that are working together to provide that service.
So does this mean you're pulling in information data feeds from my SD-WAN product in addition to what you're doing, your own instrumentation?
No, we don't pull in SD-WAN feed from other SD-WAN vendors. This is essentially performance data that ThousandEyes generates. So we can look at, you know, the overlay performance. So if it's to a SaaS application, but we can peel down the layers as well and look at that hop-to-hop underlay data as well, which we gather.
Okay, so if my SD-WAN product keeps switching to a new link because there's problems on link A, I can then go to ThousandEyes and say, what's going on with this link that I need to maybe do something about or call somebody?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's important that, you know, you have kind of like this view that's even independent of a lot of your vendors, including like the SD-WAN vendors, mm-hmm. because one of the use cases as well is looking at, for example, policy implementation. You know, you may have a policy set and, you know, you want to be able to verify that your SD-WAN solution is behaving as you expect and you're getting the performance that you want based on the policies that you're setting down. So having kind of an independent view outside of the vendor is also really helpful, just even in terms of validating that vendor.
So how does this multi-service view apply to something like a SaaS application like Office 365, which everybody's using these days?
Office 365 is an interesting one, but there's just so many different kind of pieces to it. So on one hand, you have, you know, as we mentioned, like there's the DNS piece, you know, the kind of resolving a particular domain. Mm-hmm. There's also the authentication piece. In some cases, a lot of enterprises might have some kind of hybrid authentication in place with Office 365. So not just using Azure AD, but again, it's kind of a hybrid approach.
Yeah, there's a lot of 2FA and identity management solutions. You might be using a Cisco Duo, or you need to test that as well and then correlate whether that's the reason people can't get to you Azure.
And these could be on different, like, you know, environments and, you know, domains as well, right? Like if you kind mm-hmm. of break it down into what are the first four steps that happen when you go to login.microsoftonline.com? Well, obviously the first is DNS. You've got a result to it. But what we've noticed is there's an immediate redirect to www.office.com. And then you are then again redirected to login.microsoftonline where you have to enter your login credentials. Uh-huh. So those are like different domains that you're hitting, right? Now, first off, we definitely need to monitor to all of those because that architecture can be different. But think about now, apart from monitoring, you can stitch them all together in one view. So you can very quickly identify if it's DNS, if it's, you know, office.com or, you know, the authentication
It's even more complicated in the case of SaaS services because sometimes they're using Anycast. You might be connecting from Australia and then coming into Microsoft's network in a local Australian POP and then backhauled over Microsoft's own internal network. Well, how do you know that that network is operating suboptimally when you don't have any SD-WAN in there? Because it breaks out locally, and the same thing applies. People in Europe go to the local, wherever it might be. So you really want to have not just the DNS, because the DNS is going to say, is that working? But you're also going to have to try and track, oh, but Australia's working, but India's not. But South America's up, North America's up, but Europe is down. And you can start to say, well, okay, well, maybe this Azure region is having some problems or, you know, and that it all comes back to this reducing the cost of ownership. The challenge that we've always had is when networks were smaller and less complex and apps were simpler, you know, Microsoft Word's on my desktop. Is your desktop on, sir? You know, is your printer plugged in? You know, in the case of SaaS, you know, when you go to Azure, that whole piece between the chair and the keyboard and where the app is running is this is just this invisible blob until you apply some sort of visibility tooling to say, this is working, this is working, this isn't working. But even worse, it's not that it's not working. It might be working in one part of the world or in one state, but not in another. And that actually is the core of the ThousandEyes product. You've always been that distributed monitoring. It just because it's working in one place doesn't mean it's working somewhere else.
Yeah, it's not just one invisible blob. It's 50 or 60 invisible blobs that all need to somehow find and talk to each other.
Totally. And that's a really good point because that reminds me of an issue that happened, I think this was a few weeks ago when there was an Azure AD issue. And one of the things that we noticed with that, and that was later included in Microsoft's post-incident report, was that the Azure AD service, when users were going through the authentication process, wasn't really working for a lot of users in the US and Australia, but it was actually working fairly well if you were connecting from Europe and Asia Pac. Now, again, like the application server was up and running. So if you were just pinging the service, like, are you up or down? Like everything looked fine. It was only once you were going through a transaction where you were trying to authenticate that you could tell if it was broken or not. Now, if you have that information, you know, as an enterprise, then, you know, you have options available to you because using SD-WAN or other different techniques, you can, for example, maybe change where the internet exit point is for your users in a different geo so that you're connecting them to an Anycast instance that's actually going to enable you to authenticate and get into the application.
So another thing we teased at the top of the show was you now have added capabilities for API monitoring. You're calling it adaptive API. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah. So this is, you know, it builds upon ThousandEyes's browser synthetics framework, which is based out of Selenium. So browser synthetics and transaction testing, that's not a new concept in the sense that you're essentially simulating a user workflow and interaction with an app. Now, applications, as we know, are modernized, modular, and definitely getting more API-centric. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of cases, like application workflows, you know, they trigger multiple backend API interactions. Like if you look at a ride-sharing app, for instance, they could have interaction with a payment gateway. They can have interaction with, you know, a messaging service like Twilio or like email gateway. So there are multiple interactions that happen. But not all of those interactions need explicit front-end browser triggers, right? And sometimes a workflow can involve a step that kind of needs additional information, like, you know, maybe it needs to know that you've actually been able to successfully complete your payment. Only then can it trigger an email saying your ride is now complete and your payment's done. So how do you simulate all of those backend interactions through browser synthetics? And that's what adaptive API does. It allows us, allows the user to basically go beyond emulating user interactions via a customer-facing website to execute API calls directly on API services. The reason it's adaptive is because its highly flexible framework allows us to make sure conditionally test based on the result of, you know, this API interaction. So if your API responds saying, yes, your payment has been made, then it triggers yet another interaction with the email gateway saying, now send an email. Mm-hmm. If the payment fails, then, you know, maybe it's a different set of actions that you have to execute on. So essentially being able to test, you know, all those intricacies within the app thoroughly is what adaptive API does.
Nothing really, just a bit here, a bit there, kind of touch it. Just joking. It's quite something. I mean, that whole thing is just extraordinary to me. The idea that we've come so far with APIs that we're now actually at the point where we just monitor APIs for status.
Yeah, I mean, this goes obviously more than that, right? And as with, you know, in true ThousandEyes DNA, our goal has always been, yes, there is, you know, external dependencies that occur, API, for instance, but also there is an underlying network, which happens to be the internet these days, that's carrying that traffic. So as we look at, you know, any type of application-based testing, we correlate that with the underlying layers. So what this framework, the browser synthetics and transaction testing framework allows us to do is not just, you know, create markers at different point in that interaction to see how long is it taking for, you know, your API endpoint to respond, but then cross-correlates that with the underlying network as well, saying, okay, if it's taking long, is it because of the internet or is it because the API is just taking longer to respond by itself, you know?
Well, and I think what's really interesting about this is that it goes way beyond performance monitoring, because now you're actually testing application logic, right? Like you are initiating a series of calls to an API, and then based on the response that you get, you're deciding on what actions you can take. And this enables you to effectively determine whether or not an application is behaving in the way that you expect. If you don't, for example, get a response that you expect, or it's not in sort of an approved list, then that can trigger alerts and other things to happen.
Well, we have more to talk about, but we've run out of time. So if folks want to find out more about all the new things in ThousandEyes and more about what you're up to, where should they go?
So we actually have an on-demand webinar that shows and displays all of the new features we spoke about. So it's not just Lightware. You can actually see the demo on both multi-service views and as well as adaptive API. And you can find the link in the show notes.
Fantastic. And as always, you can go to ThousandEyes.com/packetpushers for more information. Angelique and Archana, thank you for joining us, and thank you to ThousandEyes for being such a longtime sponsor of Packet Pushers. If you like this show, you can find it and many more fine free technical podcasts along with our community blog. That's at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter at Packet Pushers, find us on LinkedIn, and rate us on Apple Podcasts. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.